Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where sales leaders teach you what's working for them and how you can build it yourself.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by our sales coaching and consulting services. Are you looking to create repeatable, scalable, and predictable revenue? We've helped thousands of companies grow their business with tailored expert advice backed by testing to ensure they establish the best practices that'll work for them. Head over to bit.ly/predictable revenue coaching to learn more. Building a sales force for the first time can be a daunting task. It's tough to know who to hire, what skills and attributes you should be looking for in salespeople, and how to make sure that you actually end up with top performers on your team. And if you don't have a plan in place for how to answer all of these questions, you're simply not going to get it right the first time. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks. And today on the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting to an expert about how to build your sales force for the first time. He has an impeccable business reputation, having served as an independent president of sales and training for companies run by Tony Robbins, Chet Holmes, and Russ Whitney. He's the CEO of Business Success Factors, where he helps businesses grow and accelerate their sales revenue, as well as to expand and optimize it. He also works with B2B business coaches and consultants to help them grow their businesses so they have higher profits and a better quality of life. Doug C. Brown, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Well, thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate you having me here.
So, Doug, what are the top mistakes that people make when hiring, well, attempting to hire a top performer?
Well, the first and probably the most glaring one is they rush it. They rush the process. So, you know, the whole idea about hiring a top producer is about being aligned from the beginning. So when they rush along, they miss parts of it. They miss parts of the alignment, so they're not really set up to actually handle a top producer, and it gets them into trouble.
Okay, so let's talk about how to actually go about it the right way then, and not skip any of these vital steps. What are the three most common traits that you actually want to be looking for in a top performer, first of all?
Well, there's several of them. It depends on the role, right? But the big ones are, you're looking for a balance between ego and empathy. So ego being self-confidence, strength, ability to see it through, empathy being able to do that in a win-win fashion, you know, really care about people. Because we all know salespeople that we run into that are just like all about me and nothing about you. So it really depends on the role and what you want them to play and how specific the role. You know, there's certain traits with people who are successful and more so in sales, right, than others. So things could be, you know, as well as their skill sets that, you know, they have on the ability to sell is another thing that most people don't test. So that's, again, one part of the challenge where they get themselves into a challenge mode. They hire somebody, they think they're likable, they think they're, you know, they might even do a personality test and they fit into the organization, but then they get in there and they're like, oh my gosh, this person can't sell.
And you mentioned that it kind of depends as well on the company and the type of sale and the kind of, yeah, that would impact the type of person that you're looking for. So do you think there's a different type of top performer you're looking for if we're talking about, say, those prospectors, those SDRs versus a closing role?
Yeah, because, I mean, they have different DNA, really, what we call sales DNA. So that person who's out prospecting all the time loves that when they're true. Right? When they're a true hunter, if you will, they love the fact of calling on people. They love the challenge that they get, you know, on the pushback that they get with people. But if you take somebody who's more of a closer, or, you know, somebody who's in a farming role who's taking care of them, they don't really like the pushback. Now, closers, you know, they don't mind as well, usually the pushback aspect of it. But it's really a different role specificity for the individual. So again, it depends on what you're looking for, but there are commonalities across all three as well.
And then what about kind of company by company, as far as the type of sale that you might be making or the product or service that you're selling? Are there different types of top performers that apply to those different circumstances as well?
Well, sales specific industry knowledge is always helpful. Right? Because it's something that, you know, if you're in the I don't know, the hotel industry, and you know, RevPAR is a big word, revenue per room, right? So if you don't understand the basics, obviously that, but most of the time that can be trained. What we're looking for is the actual, do they actually have the stuff, the DNA to actually be a top performer? And do they not? And, or do they have in a specific role, do they have the ability to be a top performer? Because sometimes I go into companies and help people. We just adjust the role. The person's fine. It's just that they don't, you know, one of the biggest challenges, for example, is, you know, a top producing salesperson, they try to turn into a sales manager. Well, it's a different profile, right? I mean, a salesperson detests putting together spreadsheets. You know, a manager usually likes it, right? So, you know, pivot tables are not a salesperson's best friend.
So how do you go about testing this type of thing in the interview process? You mentioned a lot of the mistakes that companies make is not being able to effectively understand before somebody actually gets into that role, whether they can do that role effectively. What do you do? How do you figure that out?
Well, the first step is to get clear about what that role really is. You know, what specifically do they want that person to achieve? And believe it or not, a lot of job descriptions are not clear, right? So in a lot of the interview processes are not clear. So once we understand what role that is, where we want this person to play, how they want them to play, and the personality that we want driven in there, now we can start saying, okay, we've got, it's no different than if we were just doing marketing, right? I mean, we're going to look at what is the problem we solve? How do we help this person? You know, who are they? Where do we find them? I was always surprised, and I still am to today, that many people just don't do that step one. So once you do step one, then you have to have an attraction factor to build in. When you have that attraction factor coming to, you know, toward you as a company, all right, so now we've got candidates. But the question really becomes, if you want A players, are you an A player company? You know, an A player company being, you're set up to actually be able to handle a top producer, to be able to, you know, bring them on, get them going quickly, train them, give them the support, and actually be totally honest and transparent about what the realities are in the organization that they might be, you know, bringing themselves into. Because top performers do not tolerate, you know, being lied to in that capacity. And I'm not saying people directly lie to people. I'm just saying they look at it as they go, okay, wait a minute. I was told I could come in here and do X, Y, Z. Now I'm here. I can see where I can do X, Y, Z, but I also now have to do A, B, C, D, E, and F in order to, you know, and they'll just flush out at that point, because people like that generally can go sell anywhere, you know, not everywhere, but usually anywhere. And then the other thing is that once you get to that place, you got to simulate the working conditions for these folks before they actually, you know, get the offer letter. So you want to test everything that they would normally go through. So, you know, the military does a great job at this. You know, a lot of times I was in the military for 12 years. A lot of times, you know, the training was way worse than the actual mission, right? Because they're simulating things that are going to go on in the live situation. And at least you're somewhat, not totally, but somewhat prepared. But if they don't do that with a sales role, then what ends up happening is the salesperson ends up getting into situations like, wait a minute, this wasn't what we talked about, right? So we want to simulate the working conditions, and then we want to assess all of that. We want to use assessments that are specific for sales attributes. You know, do they have follow-up skills? Do they have the ability to, you know, handle rejection? I mean, all of these things are very important when you're looking at a top producer, because if they don't, then, you know, hiring mistakes are in sales and or in anything in hiring is a costly, you know, faux pas, if you will.
Sure. And these assessments, are these something that you're building yourself in house, or is this something, you know, you can get a third party kind of sales assessment?
So the interview process also should be standardized, and that you can build in house. What I would recommend is there are outside companies who do find jobs at assessments and you could just access those assessments. It's not so much the assessment that's the big challenge, it's the interpretation of the assessment. So, you know, for example, I have one that I work with, it's called Objective Management Group, right? So they put out a very nice sales assessment. They have cross-compared almost 2.2 million salespeople. It breaks it down into 21 categories. So you know specifically if they can hunt. You know specifically if they're going to ask for referrals. You know if they're comfortable with technology or not. So these type of specific skill sets that are sales specific, unlike say something like a DISC test, you know, which is a big one that a lot of people use. They'll, a DISC or certain others will measure personality traits, and that'll tell you another thing. So you use different combinations of assessments, you know, to figure it out. But I would not recommend anybody going and doing all the R&D and everything to put together their own assessments. There's thousands of assessments out there today.
Right. So there are kind of two layers of assessments that you need to be doing. The one is the personality based, because of course you still do need somebody that's going to gel with the team that works with the company and so on. But you need to incorporate the second layer of assessment, which is actually the skill set, which is something that not a lot of companies are actually doing. They kind of wait until, rely on the resume, hope that it's true, and then wait until they've got the person in the seat and see if they can do it.
I agree with you 100%. And every resume that I've ever looked at has slight or massive embellishment.
We all do that to our resumes, don't we? We're taught to do that. You talk yourself up.
I do the same thing, right? But we use the resume in the actual interview process as a way of really getting to the truth. You know, a lot of times people look at the resume and they go, hey, I did XYZ, you know, on the resume, and the people go, well, tell me, you know, how that work? And they give them an explanation, and the interviewer then goes on to the next question. But what we do is we challenge it, right? So we're constantly challenging those things within the resume, because a top performer is going to come back and respectfully be able to handle those things. So what we're doing again is we're testing the traits all the way through, because if we don't test the traits all the way through, you know, it's nice to have somebody who's just cheery and wonderful and people love them. And then all of a sudden when the person goes, I don't, it's just too much money for me at the time. And the salesperson goes, okay, thanks. And they leave, right? Because we haven't tested their own buying bias, right? Which if they're the type of person that likes to think it over, a lot of times they'll allow people to think it over because they want people to like them. We all do as human beings.
So this interview framework, you mentioned this is something you can build in-house. You pull in those external assessments. Is there any kind of methodology out there that you're basing this interview process on, or is it really something you've kind of built over the years from scratch?
Well, much of it I've kind of built over the years over scratch, but there's programs out there like the STAR program and different types of programs that are actually quite good at doing this, which I utilize all the time when I help clients, right? I mean, what I've learned is I don't have to be the smartest guy in the room. I just have to be the person who can get the smartest things to my clients, right? The most up-to-date, relevant things for them. And then my clients win, so therefore I win. But yeah, there's different programs out there that you can adapt. What I've done is I've taken pieces of each programs, and then sort of put it into a I have put it into a process for people.
Very cool. Okay. Let's imagine that we've ironed out that interview process. We know what we're looking for. We've figured out what assessments we're using and that process that we're using for interviews. Let's get into actually building that team. So how many sales reps should you start with right at the beginning if you're building a sales force from scratch?
One. You start with one. And if you're building it from scratch, I mean, the first thing you know, you're going to learn a lot by just having one rep. And, you know, I'm not a recruiter. You know, I don't do that type of work. And I can hear recruiters who might listen to this going, no, you know, right? Because they get paid on every placement. But the truth be told is it really depends on the objective, what's trying to be accomplished. But you always want to start off with the first one. the first person, right? So let's see if we can get that person to work, because you're going to learn a lot when you're starting out like this. We all think we understand what the client behavior is going to be, even if we, you know, because we've been in it for 20 years and now we're going to take someone else and we're going to put them into the same position and they have this knowledge here at this company. So they're just going to be successful. That's what a lot of people think. But the truth be told is that 20 years could be some good habits and some bad habits. So we want to take that first person and help them get successful. That doesn't mean you can't recruit for more. You know, I always teach companies to consistently recruit, always have resumes coming in, because you never know when somebody's going to leave. Right. But one would be the initial answer that I would give people.
And when do you think is the right time to ramp that up and scale?
As soon as you're at a place where you know, your salesperson is going, I can't handle this, right? Before you get to that place, and you can see it in the numbers a lot of times. Now, it also depends on the type of funding that you have. I'm talking about somebody who's organically starting it up. You know, if you have venture capital funding at $140 million, go build a team, right? You have the time, the money, and the ability to hire other people to manage that. But remember, as you start adding more salespeople onto it, it's still, you've got to manage these folks. You've got to coach these folks. That's another mistake that companies make. They bring them in, they think they're a top producer, they are, but they don't coach them. They don't have weekly coaching with them or bi-weekly coaching with them and help, you know, improve the odds within the process. But, you know, once you understand where you want to go, and if you want to ramp, let's say you want to ramp up $10 million and your average sale is, I don't know, $5,000. Well, you can just take that number, start dividing it back, understand the amount of sales that need to happen. Once we understand the amount of sales that need to happen, then we can start looking at, okay, how, you know, what kind of headcount do we really need?
Mm-hmm. Got it. And what about sales process? Because of course, with one rep early stage, maybe it's okay to have minimal sales process. It might be kind of being built as you go, but certainly when you try to scale, you've got to figure that one out. So do you think you need to have built out that sales process before you go out and hire that first salesperson?
It's smart to have a framework. Now, again, if you're hiring your first salesperson, that process may change as you get into the sales. So because we think we understand and the client may have a different expectation, we may end up having to alter the role a little bit, right? Like I've been in sales roles where I am the customer service department. I am the fulfillment department, right? Even though there's other people fulfilling, I have to stay on top of that order and make sure that it goes through. So it really depends. Again, I don't want to be vague about this, but it's really kind of fluid in that regard. But having sales processes in place will allow one to systematize. And so, you know, as we get your first person and then into the next second, third, fourth person, you want to have more process. And this is something that, you know, a lot of companies, when they ask this question, they're like, oh my God, I don't have it all in play. Well, you don't need it all in play, but you need some in play and you need enough in play. And then we need to work every single week on improving that, because as we learn something, we'll change the process. I have a client right now that they were setting appointments up and the appointments weren't showing, or when they were showing, the marketing that was coming through wasn't as congruent as they wanted it to be, and therefore messaging was off. So we did a preemptive strike. You know, we send out an email that basically says, here, everything we're going to talk about is in this email. Let me know if you still want to meet. Mm. And when I first presented this idea, they went, oh, no, we're not going to get as many appointments. And I said, let's test it. Right. So we did. And they got a few less appointments, but they got a much higher closing percentage. Right. So people don't like to be surprised, you know, especially when they come in and it's like, all right, well, this is a $50,000 item. And they're thinking, well, geez, I wanted to spend, you know, maybe $15,000 or $20,000. They don't like to be surprised like that, especially if that is a $150,000 item and they were thinking $15,000. So you might as well just tell people up front, look, here's what we're going to be into. You know, do you still want to meet? And yes, you'll lose a few here and there, but that the reality is they were never going to likely buy the majority of them anyway. So now you freed up time to go actually find people who might.
Sure. Makes sense. And you mentioned a little bit earlier that you need to be equipped to handle a top performer. It's not just a case of figuring out who you want, but actually being able to kind of support, empower, enable them once you have them. So what does a company need to have in place for certain before they can actually handle a top performer?
Training is a clear onboarding process. I'm not talking about human resources onboarding. I'm talking about a clear sales onboarding. Right? What is going to happen every day in this sales role that I need to know right out of the gate? And without those first two, now training can be structured, but it can be less structured in the beginning, right? Same with the onboarding process. You'll learn as you go along, but we have to have a process and tell the truth right up front. Listen, you know what? We're a privately funded startup company, right? We're a publicly funded startup company, or we're a company that's been in business for 5 years. You know, we're doing, I don't know, $3 million. And we now want to build a sales team. So you're going to be responsible for X, Y, and Z. That's the onboarding I'm talking about. Clear understanding of what they're getting themselves into prior to even having the job offer made out. And then, so in the onboarding, that's how you bring them on. And then you're going to have consistent training, because a lot of times people think, well, top performers, they don't need training. But top performers crave training, right? They like to have challenge. They like to know new things. And, you know, all of a sudden, wow, that's a nice idea. Geez, I never thought about this. I'll start to employ it because I can see the leverage in it. That's what top producers do.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're like a sponge for new information, and they're always trying new things and adapting they're not stagnant in what they do. And you mentioned that's also one of the fears of kind of confusing a veteran salesperson with a top performing salesperson is right. With that veteran salesperson, you maybe get 20 years of bad habits that are really tough to break. And someone who's like, I don't want your training. I know what I'm doing, versus a top performer who could maybe only have 3 years of experience, but show this kind of consistent adaptability, coachability, all that kind of stuff, as well as their numbers being hit.
Yeah, I worked with a major television company. I won't say what their name is, but they have three big letters. so that'll narrow it down for some people. But they had a division that was like a public broadcasting division. And it wasn't PBS, right? It was a different provider, and their numbers were dropping like crazy. And so when I went and looked at them, I mean, they had people there that were there for 30, 40 years, right? And had become jaded. They had become to a place where it was like they were used to getting the business. It was kind of like the old days where, you know, if you worked for IBM, you got leads, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And they were used to having all this incoming business. But then the internet came along and actually shifted all of this. And so now some of the spending started moving away from television, started moving toward radio, podcasting, you know, other types of electronic medium. And so they were just like clueless on what to do. And, you know, hey, we've been doing it this way forever. And now they're still trying to do it that way forever because they're so entrenched in it. So then when you bring in new top performing talent, they're like, why are you doing it here? You know, like we're using social media. We're using, you know, we're not, you know, they're not answering their phones anymore. They, you know, they're answering text or whatever it might be, right? For that particular. Or, hey, we're going to try this type of event, you know, and we're going to self-fund it through the sales process ourselves. There's all kinds of different ways that top performers, they look for avenues. How do I get this account? Not just how do I farm the account because I've been there for a long time.
Right. Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit then from the management side, how, if you've got one of these people that have those skills, they seem like they're going to be a great top performer. How do you continue to manage them and keep them that way?
Well, you're constantly challenging them. That's one thing. They love a constant challenge. Most of these top producers. Now, with that being said, you know, also understand that top producers usually have a very strong mind and they can be a bit rogue, if you will, right? They will in many cases be a maverick. So top producers will, you know, mow down 25 acres of grass to get to the target and keep going till they get there. But at the same time, they might be a bit disruptive into process because they're usually using unconventional methods in getting to that place, right? And they'll do things that other people won't do. They'll do things that will just surprise a lot of people. From the acceptable to the not acceptable in some regards, right?
So debatably acceptable.
Yeah. So I mean, we manage them, you know, in a way that we get the mission done, the client wins, the salespeople win as well. And because, you know, the myth that people in sales only work for money is a myth, especially in today's economy, you know, where everything is, you know, we were talking about COVID prior to the call. You know, quality of life is becoming a much bigger motivator for top producers than actual cash.
Sure.
So, you know, we want to look at what their aspirations are, what they want, be very clear and help support those. Because the truth be told is we're not just hiring salespeople, we're hiring human beings who know how to produce. But human beings have fears, wants, needs, desires, right? And they have goals. So if we can help build them up as people and build their goals up in the process of helping them in their sales process, they'll be loyal and they'll, you know, like I said, they will mow down 25 acres to get to that next place in the hot sun.
And you mentioned that a lot of these top producers are going to be these mavericks. They're people who are willing to go outside of the box. They're original, they're creative. Yeah. So if that is the case, how would one scale a top performing sales team to say 100 reps? Like you become one of these huge companies, you take off. How can you distill and replicate 100 mavericks? What do you do?
So you must have a framework for them. Right? It's not like they won't comply to regulations. It is more of if you don't make it clear what the boundaries are and what is acceptable, then they'll push past that.
Right.
So let me give you an example because, you know, I've always been usually number one or number two in every company that I've ever worked for over the years. So I worked for this telecommunications company. It was called Paytech Communications. We had 315 sales reps. I was, on the top of the play. And I'm sitting there and I had to have these clients and I recognized that we can do something technologically. So we used to provide digital circuits. I'll keep it very basic. But I realized that these clients were actually having to buy extra circuits from the competition, Verizon, things like that, where in our technology, we could take the same circuit, peel off a few channels of that digital circuit, and give them the bandwidth that they needed. And we could do this by tying these two together per location, because a lot of times they used to buy what they call point-to-point lines. And back then they were really costly. Sometimes they're $5,000 a month. So, but they only needed, say, 128 kilobytes of data at that time, or 256, yeah. Right? So I would peel off, say, four channels, and I would be able to connect them. So I knew technologically this will work. So I also knew it would be a long and arduous process trying to get this through corporate at that time, right? So I went out and sold six clients, major names, what we called tie lines. Well, I called them tie lines. So I sold them. I got the contracts. I got five-year deals. I got, you know, everything. And I go and I submit the orders to the engineering department. I'm sitting at my desk and I literally hear the head engineer go, "Doug Brown, you son of," and you know, expletive, yeah. expletive, 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 right? And I hear him coming down the corridor, and I'm laughing because I know why he's going to be here. His name was Peter. He's a super guy. So Peter comes through and he goes, "What the bleepy bleepity bleep bleep bleep?" And I said to Peter, I said, "Well, this is what they required, right? This is the win-win for them. I just saved them $20,000 a month, you know, on this." He goes, "But we don't have this." I said, "Can we do it?" He said, "Well, in theory, I think we can." "In theory, or can we do it?" He goes, "Yeah, we can make this happen, but we have no product set. We have no this, we have no that." I said, "You're the engineer.
Figure it out."
So it went to my boss and my boss's boss and all the way up the chain, right? And to the C-level of the company. And long story short, they made it a full product set of that company, and they made, you know, probably tens of millions of dollars a month in time off that particular thing. So Mavericks, you know, they'll do things like that. They'll disrupt the status quo and they'll make the organization grow in a different direction. However, if I knew that that was a no-no, you know, that I'm not supposed to do that because that was what I was told, then I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
Right. But they'll just do off the wall, good things a lot of times.
Right.
And they'll take risks. I mean, I walked in one time, I was prospecting somebody for 3 years, and I walked into their office with a cake, lit all the candles up. I said, "Could you invite out, you know, this Margot?" And she's been pushing me off for 3 years. And she's like, "What do you want?" I'm like, "I'm here to celebrate our 3-year anniversary." "It's been 3 years I've been calling upon you. I figured we should celebrate. And by the way, I bought enough cake for everybody in the office."
Nice.
Right. And so what ended up happening is they had an office party that went on. And guess what? I got invited in and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. So you got to be prepared that they're going to be innovative and do things like that.
Right. So you definitely don't want to stunt any of that innovation. But of course, you can lay out some boundaries so that it doesn't potentially harm the brand. But you do want to give your, regardless of kind of your sales process and your structure, you do want to give those salespeople the opportunity to go above and beyond in some ways that are outside of the box. But you can just rein it in a little so that it's not too harmful.
Of course. And if you do that, I mean, look, you don't want your people, you know, rappelling off the roof to get down to the 17th floor window and knocking on the CEO. That's going to probably be a little bit more disruptive than need be. I remember a gentleman that I know very successfully sold his company for $1 billion. He was a consummate top producing sales guy. He told me a story one time about how he sold Texas Instruments. He was trying to get in there for years. He couldn't get in. And he walked in one day. And he said, "I'd like to speak to Mr. X." And there was a lady at the desk at the time. And she said, "Well, you know, who do I tell him is here?" Mm-hmm. Right. And he said, "Well, tell him it's his brother." Right. And so he walks out, the gentleman walks out, sees this other gentleman, and he goes, "How dare you? How dare you impersonate my brother?" Right. Yeah. And so the top performing rep said, "Well, sir, I believe in the eyes of God that we are all brothers. And therefore I am your brother." And the guy laughed and invited him in, and he nailed down a multi-million dollar deal with Texas Instruments every single year.
So interesting. Those are some great stories. Yeah. Just a prime example of why a top performer has those two sides to them. Like we said at the beginning, it's both on the kind of behavioral side, the personality side, that you want this creative, driven, innovative type of person. But if you want that top performer and you want to build out that sales force and you want to scale it, they do need those hard skills that are going to be able to get the job done, get those deals across the line, and make the most out of all of the contacts or leads or prospects, however you want to put it.
That's absolutely correct. And I would add one thing. We also want to know that they have the will to actually want to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? Because there are a lot of people who are really, who can be skilled in sales, but they don't have the drive. And so if you don't test for that drive, that will to win and will to sell, then what ends up happening is you end up with somebody who's very skilled, but it's not very motivated. I have a client right now. He was hiring them quite frequently that way from big companies paying huge salaries. They would come in, but they're used to a huge salary environment with all kinds of support. And he's a startup company, right? Well-funded, but a startup company. And so the reps are having a very difficult time because they're used to coming in and having that ability, but they don't have that really that high will to go after the business. So, it's costing him hundreds of thousands of dollars just in base salary to figure this thing out. Yeah. But after I got done talking with him, I'm like, listen, why don't we just test for this? And he's like, I didn't know that could happen. Right. So now he doesn't make the same hiring errors.
Awesome. And that's exactly what we intended to teach everybody in this episode today, was how to get it right the first time following this framework that you've built over the years doing this with so many different companies. So thank you so much. Perfect place to kind of wrap it up. If people want to learn more from you, Doug, if they want to get in touch with you, where can they do that?
Well, they can get in touch with me, but three different ways. They can either go to LinkedIn, which a lot of people like. It's Doug Brown, 1234. They could call the company, 603-595-0303. They can email me, doug@businesssuccessfactors.com. I do have people who check my email, so, but they'll let me know. And if they want to learn more about what we do, there's different ways. I also have a book out there. It's called Win-Win Selling, Unlocking the Profitability by Resolving Objections. I wrote a whole book on the psychology and philosophy of objections. And they can get that at winwinsellingbook.com.
Perfect. I'm going to just jot that down right now so that I can add it to the show notes and the blog post, winwinsellingbook.com. Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Doug, for joining us on the Predictable Revenue Podcast. It was an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Sarah. I really appreciate you having me on.
And thank you to all of you guys for tuning in to another episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast. We will catch you next time.